It's the Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM in Toronto. And I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And we have several topics we're going to be talking about today. And the latter part of the show, we're going to do what is becoming a kind of feature. We're going to talk about organized labor and the goings-on in the union movement some of the issues faced, and they all seem to be coming together, by the way, a little vortex, is that the word, for a number of political crises as well as human crisis in the case of Los Angeles and the responses to it. It involves unions, and so Tony Leo will be joining us to talk about that. there's a major organizing drive has been going on in couple of sectors of the American economy which had never previously been organized, and there's a great fight over that. I want to make sure I announce right at the beginning that on January the 19th at 1 p.m., that's a Sunday, in Hamilton, there will be a demonstration at 1605 Main Street West, and the issue is the a speech that's going to be given by Melissa Lantzman. She is the deputy leader of the Conservative Party, and this, by the way, is the demonstration is being one of the sponsors, and the place that you can find more information is the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. They, together with other organizations, are protesting because Melissa Lantzman is, like the leader of the Conservative Party, sees the main issue of the day in the Middle East as stronger, louder support for Israel. And they have, at a time when actually world opinion and not only expressed by popular demonstrations all over the globe, but also at the United Nations and at the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court. These, there's been a finding and it's certainly a consensus that the people of Gaza are being targeted violently, illegally, and it's an international tragedy because there is actually no power that is stepping in to say or do anything to interfere with this. And the people, and at this time, the Conservative Party thinks the most important thing to do is to reassert how much they support the state of Israel. And that's had many Canadians very concerned. So there will be this demonstration, January 19th, that's a Sunday, 1 p.m., 1605 Main Street West. I believe Independent Jewish Voices is probably the initiator of this demonstration. It is to protest the appearance of Melissa Lantzman in Hamilton, and I hope everybody in the area will attend. Now, the big story of the day, or certainly the one most talked about, whether Justin Trudeau says he doesn't think we should be talking about it because he says it's, quotes, not going to happen. But people have the impression maybe it is. This is the talk about how much pressure Donald Trump is bringing on Canada to get his way. And I guess I would put the proposition, you can have a country if you can keep it. And that's always been the challenge. And in the spirit of I believe in which we should be responding to this crisis, I don't really agree that the appearance of Doug Ford on Fox television is advancing the Canadian cause. It's embarrassing. And of course, the visit to Mar-a-Lago, the Don of Mar-a-Lago, opened his doors to a visitor representing, they claim, Alberta, the Premier of Alberta. She's not representing the Canadian government. She couldn't. She has no status in that respect. She not only met the Don of Mar-a-Lago, but she met two other people there that listeners to the to CIUT and the Taylor Report, and even if they read the papers, were known are not the most popular fellows. One is Jordan Peterson, and the other is Kevin O'Leary, who is calls himself a shark, or is from a shark pit or something. And both these individuals have kind of smiled appreciatively at the thought of becoming the 51st state. Probably, by the way, in the back of her mind, it would be the premier herself. But this is a somewhat farcical, and it erased to me the specter of a very important Canadian. He might, I would say, the soul of, representing the soul of Canada, and that would be Farley Mowat, who wrote a book, And No Birds Sang, an account of his participation as a soldier in World War II. And I believe that book, And No Birds Sang, will outlive the country and outlive the United States in terms of just being a piece of literature that will live on because how well it was done, how truthful and powerful. And Farley Mowat seems to be always, he's been relegated to the sidelines, and I think I know why. His name should be all over the newspapers now as one of those voices. Every country has literary people, singers, poets, who say things that help define the country and explain the world to others. And Mowat is in that category. So anyway, I'm taking a long time to tell you. I'm going to read a letter to his son, and this was written at the time of the Vietnam War, if you've heard about that. And it was later published in a collection of essays regarding Canada and its relationship to a great power that was at that time, let's put it this way, interfering via napalm and high altitude bombing and destruction of Vietnam. And many Canadians were disturbed and did not want to be associated with it and wanted to try to help bring the war to an end. And Farley Mowat wrote to his son, and here's what he had to say. My dear Sandy, a couple of months ago, you asked me whether I thought it had been worthwhile to have spent so much of my time and energy tilting against American windmills, feeling that there was a certain measure of condescension in the question. I replied with one of my facile TV-type answers, to wit, that there can be no other real choice open to a Canadian except to resist the Yanks and all their works, so that we, as a people and a nation, may escape being ingested into the eagle's gut, never to emerge again, except maybe as a patch of excrement upon the pages of world history. That would have disposed of your question, but it didn't. And the damn thing has been festering within me ever since. It has finally forced me, very reluctantly, you can believe, to make a new evaluation of the belief which has sustained me through some 20 years of waging verbal warfare against the encroachments of Uncle Sam. Have I indeed been wasting my time? I'm afraid, God help me, that I have. I can no longer convince myself that we have even a snowball's chance in hell of escaping ultimate ravishment at the hands of the Yankee succubus. And what really hurts is the belated recognition on my part that there never was much change, that Canadians have become so fatally infected with a compulsive desire to be screwed, blued, and tattooed as minions of the USA, that they not only do not wish to be saved, they're willing to fight against salvation with all ferocity of cornered rats. So wipe that smug smile off your face. You knew it all along, eh? Well, I should have known it too. God what? Enough people have tried to put me straight. There was Joy Smallwood, for one, as a smart promoter as ever hustled a vote, who gave me a fatherly lecture about a year ago. What the U.S. wants, it will get, he told me. And if we don't give them what they want, they'll take it anyway. And what they want is most of what we've got. That was about as clear an expression of real politics as one can expect from the political animal, even if it was primarily a rationalization intended to excuse our political masters for having already given the Yanks almost everything of any value in this country. Nevertheless, Joy's point was well taken, since those who rule, they do not govern. The word implies statesmanship combined with honorable intention, have, for their own reasons, long since sold us out. Or maybe they just saw the light a long way back and, in keeping with their dubious professional practices, took the line of least resistance. Some of them, that is, others sold out with deliberate intent. One day, I must tell you the full and stirring story of the greatest of all such statesmen, C.D. Howe, and how he put us on the block. Of course, Howe's plan was to sell us down the river on the national scale, and we've progressed since then. Now, every single province is trying to conduct its own sellout in direct competition with the Ottawa salesman, and it wouldn't surprise me much to see the game, which is called who'll sell out the mostest, the soonest, reach right down to the municipal level before too long. Hell, what am I saying? It's past that point already. Witness the almost frantic rush of businessmen and owners of Canadian resources to sell themselves and their holdings, their holdings, I mean ours, of course, for a quick handful of Yankee bucks. Joy, that's Joy Smallwood, wasn't the only one to point me in the direction of acute awareness, and I must add in my own defense that I wasn't as stupid as you may think. I realized what the politicians, at least, were up to ages ago. My naivety, if such it was, lay in my continuing conviction that the people of this land would not forever continue to acquiesce in this piecemeal betrayal of themselves and their country. I was much influenced by what took place in Cuba, and before that, in Mexico. I believe that in such small, relatively powerless serf states, if they could muster the guts to really kick Big Uncle in the backside, the people of Canada might be goaded into an equivalent demonstration of courage. Alas, Canadians are not Mexicans or Cubans, and I realize now that I miscalculated on a horrendous scale in ever thinking that Canadians would risk cutting off Rich Uncle's dole by assuming the posture of a man. This is a fact that I'm going to have to learn to live with. We have become a prostrate people by our own volition. Actually, the only time Canadians ever raise themselves on their elbows these days is to defend their chosen masters and to attack with the bitter hostility only known to turncoats those who dare reproach them for their spineless espousal of slave status. If this letter to you should ever see publication, the response in the letters to the editor column will show you what I mean. But there is no point in running on about what's past. My concern is for the future, because the future contains a world into which you'll have to live. So I have a few words of wisdom for you. Here speaks the old elder, and if I belabor the obvious a bit, bear with me. Despite poor old Lester Pearson's recent statement in Maclean's that, quotes, "The Americans are the least imperialistic people in history." Honest to God, that's what he said. "The Yanks now control the largest empire the world has ever known. Its citizens have, as Henry Luce, founder of Canada's two favorite magazines, Life and Time, once put it, now risen to the challenge to accept wholeheartedly the duty and opportunity as the most powerful and vital nation in the world, and in consequence, to exert upon the world the full impact of our influence for such purposes as we see fit and by such means as we see fit." Italics my own, said Moy. In this delightfully frank statement, combined with one by John Foster Dulles, quotes, "There are two ways of conquering a foreign nation. One is to gain control of its people by force of arms. The other is to gain control of its economy by financial means. You have the essential dogmas subscribed to by the military, political, economic hegemony that runs the USA. Once you understand this dogma, you will have no difficulty understanding the significance of current events in Spain, Korea, Greece, Formosa," that would be now called Taiwan, by the way, "the Philippines, Venezuela, Dominica, and the rest of the 60-odd surf states, which are euphemistically referred to as U.S. client states. Note with particular attention that most of these U.S. client states are run by military, aristocratic, or political juntas of a totalitarian nature. Juntas whose prime allegiance is to is to the hungry eagle rather than to their own peoples. Juntas, many of which are maintained in power by the United States through classic applications of the principles of bribery, blackmail, subversion, and armed force. Or, if you find such a mass of evidence too complex for easy assimilation, take a long look at Vietnam instead. Observe, if you dare, the fantastic and fearful similarities between the way the United States is behaving in that small and benighted country and the way Hitler behaved in his heyday. Having done one or the other, preferably both, I ask you to consider the reality behind the American claims, ably supported by such pillars of righteousness as our own Paul Martin, to being the world's greatest defenders of democracy." Democracy! My God, it is to laugh, but bitter laughter it must be, since demonstrably the United States is currently engaged in almost every form of domestic and external brutality, aggrandizement, degradation of the individual, and the destruction of freedom, which, so the USA maintains with a straight face, are the singular hallmarks of the beast called communism. And what, you say, is this tirade in aid of? Well, it is intended to ensure you harbor no further illusions about living in a democracy or being protected by one. You, my son, are a helot, born and bred under the aegis of the United States, and you damn well better come to terms with this inescapable fact. The illusion of democracy is one that you and your generation can ill afford to nurture. You must recognize that hard reality, which is not at all cherry-flavored words of all the hucksters in the world can adequately conceal. You are a serf, no more than that. And Massa lives way down south. You must rid yourself of this delusion, because as I see things, there's no guarantee that the privileged position presently enjoyed by Canadians as most favored serfs will last. The day is near when the Yankees will see no further need to pamper us. They'll own us outright. And then we may expect to be subjected to the same forms of direct oppression that have been inflicted on most of the other peoples inhabiting the two American continents. The steady growth of overt totalitarianism within the master state itself brings ominous intimations that the good fat days for the people who sold themselves into bondage may even now be drawing to a close. And remember, a man who sells himself into slavery does not earn the gratitude of his master. Instead, he earns a deep contempt. We Canadians have well earned such contempt. A wise slave knows that a contemptuous master is more to be feared in the long run than an angry one. Which leads me to an aside, I think worth making. Not all Canadians have sold themselves. As you are well aware, the French Canadians in Quebec don't share our desire for self-immolation. They are resisting, and thereby rousing our particular hatred and resentment. Why so? It is because we really fear the development of a true federation of two nations. Many other countries live with such federations and live well. It is because we are deathly afraid that the intransigence of Quebec will draw the cold and hooded stare of the eagle, and thereby expose us, by implication, to the furies meted out to helots who revolt. What I am trying to tell you is that nobody can, at this late stage, reverse the tide. Quebec, bravely as she may struggle, will fail, and so your own survival now depends on your becoming as selfishly inclined, as amoral as the men who have brought you and this country to its present sorry pass. You must needs become one of them. And you might as well become one of the overseer class if you can make the grade. I recommend that you enter politics. Although you have not yet displayed the requisite capabilities of duplicity, cowardice, self-serving, and betrayal, which pass for morality in high places, you might improve with practice, if it is at least certain that a political career is one of the few available that will permit you to enjoy with any security or tenure the benefits accrued by renegades and sycophants. You might conceivably consider entering the business world as an alternative, but the opportunities it offers are strictly limited. This is the Holy of Holies, and since its true hierarchy is almost exclusively composed of citizens of the master state, whether they are card-carrying citizens or de facto citizens is of no import, the chances of a helot rising to those secure seats of power are almost non-existent. But as a politician, you would be employed in the services of the business god, and as a valuable and trusted slave, you might be deserving of good treatment and assured of a safe niche. There's another course you might consider taking. You could follow the example of so many of your compatriots and anticipate events by journeying to Rome before the Marines come north for you. As a beginning, you could voluntarily enlist in the Legions of the Eagle and thereby gain the jump on those of your generation who do not yet realize that the day approaches when the Ottawa satraps will join Australia, New Zealand, and others such in sending levies to fight America's wars for her. Since you have no Negro, Indian, Eskimo, or other dubious blood in your veins, you ought to be able to wrangle a cushy job, far from the sound of battle and from the stench of burning babies. Eventually, you could hope to be rewarded with citizenship in the master state. And although this would require that you reject all you have heretofore been taught to believe in is good in man, it would at least provide you with something you never had before, a verifiable nationality. I have only suggested a few of the possible funk holes, and you will easily think of many more. The point is that you should be thinking about them very seriously. And right now, the time is running out for your fellow slaves who bargain with a kindly, who are complacent and myopic, as they are, believe they have made a splendid bargain with a kindly master. The cold and brutal hours when they learn the truth and when they learn the price of their betrayal of themselves and of their land lies close at hand. God help them, for no one else will wish to, if they could. That's a letter by Farley Mowat to his son, and it was published in the New Romans, Candid Canadian Opinions of the U.S., and that was edited by Ed Purdy. Timely, I would say. We have a little bit of music from a guy named Lead Belly who suffered under the American government, a prisoner, etc., and he sang about bullies.
The town. I'm looking for that bully, baby. Bully of the town. Looking for that bully, but that bully can't be found. Well, I'm looking for that bully of the town. When I walk this levee round, 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 every day I may be found. When I walk this levee round, well, I'm looking for that bully of the town. Looking for that bully mama, bully of the town. Looking for that bully, but that bully can't be found. Well, I'm looking for that bully of the town. Looking for that bully mama, bully of the town. Looking for that bully that shot the woman down. Well, I'm looking for that bully of the town. When I walk this levee round, every day I may be found. When I walk this levee round, well, I'm for that bully of the town.
Tater Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'll remind you again, I have read you quite a lengthy letter by Farley Mowat. Farley Mowat is, I would argue, is the closest thing to representing the Canadian soul. And he is not featured and talked about enough. I would say look into it. Farley Mowat once was blocked from entering the United States because someone said that he had fired a rifle at a high-flying American military plane. It was an anecdote based on nothing, as far as I know. But he was supposed to give a lecture of all places, Chico State in the U.S., and they stopped him from entering the U.S. And later, when they realized that He had read books that even Americans read in the tens of thousands. They apologized and let him come. Not that he was terribly enthusiastic about going. Farley was one tough individual. He slogged his way through as a combatant in the Second World War. I'm going to say it over and over. One of the most memorable books, and I'm talking about books for it would be read anywhere in the world by anyone. No birds sang. Before we go to Tony Leah, I want to just remind you that I think Democracy Now! Has been pointing this out. We want to underline it, that there was a different response from the Republic of Mexico to the Donald Trump's talk. Their president appeared and said, we're here to talk about this. U.S. is going to put a tariffs on us, and that they're thinking about taking in countries, taking in territories like Greenland, Panama, and they seem to have a mistaken idea about the history of the continent. And the president, Sheinbaum of Mexico, produced a map. By the way, she also produced a historian with a pointer who explained what the map was. It was a Spanish map of the Americas, and it featured two-thirds of the North American continent was labeled on that map, which was created in the 1600s, America Mexicana. And then when the historian had finished talking about it, President Sheinbaum said, I like the sound of that. I'll remind you that Los Angeles, which is currently on fire, is the second largest Mexican city on the continent after Mexico City. America has certain national questions inside its borders that rarely come up. It seems to me Canadians' duty to remind them, although they won't. We're currently told that our leader is a rotund hero, Doug Ford, and that he's representing. So he goes on Fox Television and he says, Canada's not for sale, forgetting that Trump didn't say he was going to buy it. He said he was going to annex it. That's not a purchase. That's a hostile takeover. And speaking of Mexico again, remember that in 2016, when elected, Donald Trump said, I'm going to build a wall along the Mexican border, and the Mexicans are going to pay for it. Now he's saying, I want the border, Canadian border, to be secured in a manner that satisfies me, the Don of Mar-a-Lago. And Ford, the heroic premier, said, yeah, we got to do something about that border. And the visitor from Alberta, the premier of Alberta, she has access to the mysterious power himself. And she did a selfie, bunch of selfies with him and Mr. Jordan, Jordan Peterson, and O'Reilly, I guess his name is. And she said she's going to put people at the border. I'm going to make a point. The border is the responsibility of the sovereign government of Canada. She's talking about sheriff's deputies. And the problem about a border, which might lead us to talk sometime about Ukraine-Russia, problem about a border is that the peace and security and the integrity of the border is a two-sided matter. On our side, it has to be Canadian authority, not Alberta authority and some sheriff. But by the way, and some people like to use the word corruption. You know how quickly that would lead to corruption? If you allow the sheriffs to be the guys who are discussing with the American authority on the other side of the border, because when you have people guarding a border, they can talk to each other. They actually come and meet you. Okay, here's the border. I'm securing on my side. You're securing on yours. That is not a provincial job or state job. That is actually the country. I can't resist. I'm going to tell you a quick story. Then we'll go to our friend Tony Leah. But there is a story about the two soldiers standing at a border, and there was a war going on between their countries, but they were standing talking to each other as on guard duty. So the one says to the other, so what are you guys fighting for? Why are you fighting us? And the guy says, I really can't tell you for sure. I don't know. I'm not a politician. But as I was told that I might be able to get, if I fight for my country, I'll be given some land. And I really need land. And that means a lot to me. So that's why I'm doing that. Otherwise, I don't know. And by the way, what are you fighting for? And the other guard said, I fight for honor. And the first guy said, I guess everybody fights for what they don't have. So anyway, we're in a, I would call it politically perilous situation, primarily because people don't know the fundamentals. They don't know how to, that protocol, that, you know, all these things have to be kind of automatic. We've been so much asleep, as Farley Mowat's letter indicated, that we don't know the first thing about how you deal with another country. You don't let a premier go off and speak as though he represents Canada. He doesn't represent Canada. He represents, in the case of Ford, he represents Ontario. And he's susceptible to manipulation by the power that he's talking to. You know, but as Mowat pointed out in his letter, he, of course, is a lapdog, so he just likes to cuddle and be petted. And same goes for the Premier of Alberta. We actually need a national consensus, and I'll finally coming back to Tony Leah, I'm going to make this point. The business community and the bankers have been having meetings, and they're talking, and the top political class, whoever that might be, are meeting with the business leaders and with the bankers and the government. So we could ask the question, where is the labor movement? Why isn't organized labor, who, by the way, what defines them, they don't own companies. So the people who don't own the companies but produce the wealth, they have things called unions. Why aren't the unions meeting?